on the thing of it. I remember welding some one time. It would burn up, so they have to keep it cool. So this video that Wesley's talking about shows that that what they came up with, actually they don't say it in the video, but they kind of copied a Russian design where instead of having tubes run all over the engine, they would have like a double plate system, you know, your main nozzle, and then there would be a void and then another nozzle, you know, matching it. So you have this big void in between, and you would float the gases through that, the coal gases through that set of nozzles. And, but to do that was very hard. They use wax and different methods to try to do that. But nowadays, they could 3D these things. They could 3D the channels, you know, and it's really changed everything. But yeah, I saw the very good video. Back to WS2.
Yeah, I, for many of ham radio operators listening to this report, it was kind of puzzle to see why when we deliver fuel to the trot of combustion chamber, it also to have a compressor and pump from the other side cooling it. But actually it is a cooling that stops. Yeah, it is very spectacular when you're looking at the rocket, and at the bottom of the rocket, you see those huge, humongous nozzles in the cone-like shape, at least similar to that. And then you see that the liquid nitrogen that is, I'm not sure if at that stage it is liquid nitrogen or it's nitrogen, so you can correct me with that, and then you see the fume of the nitrogen going out. And then you think, okay, well, we need temperature there, we need thrust there, so why do we need the nitrogen there? And the nitrogen is not exactly in the house. It is in the wall of that cone. So yes, that technique was actually in the video how they did it in the 70s. So if you can say a few words and correct me, there is at the beginning liquid nitrogen, or it is just nitrogen that is being pumped there.
Yeah, the nitrogen is coming from the ground support. You know, when it's in flight, a rocket engine needs to have their impellers spinning. The pump's got to be spinning. What spins that is, they have a couple of different methods. Mainly, you wind up taking the gas, for the space shuttle, the liquid hydrogen would be spinning up one impeller, which turns the pump, which then the pump in turn pushes the liquid hydrogen into the combustion chamber. And then next to it, you have a similar setup. You have liquid oxygen flowing down from the tanks. Oxygen would be spinning the impeller spins the pump, and the pump it would turn and push the liquid oxygen into the combustion chamber. You know, it would be atomized there, and the two would meet, and they'd be happy exploding, pushing the space shuttle forward. So yeah, that's the idea of it. But the reason the nitrogen comes into play is before this process starts with the spinning of the liquid hydrogen, the spinning of the liquid oxygen, they have to start spinning it in the first place without using that. And they have ground support nitrogen being fed into those impellers to spin both pumps. And that only happens in the very beginning, just to get them going, to get the process going. You know, I remember seeing a scrub one time because the ground support nitrogen supply was fouled up. The valve wasn't opening or something. But that's the reason you're about the nitrogen. That is not in flight. They don't need the nitrogen. You won't see that in flight. Back to you, Wes.
Thank you very much for that. The next video that I have sent you was prototyping rocket tiny injectors. So the same guy a skilled in physics who has a machining shop. He has also friends who have 100,000 5-axis CNC mill. And he started 2 years ago with nothing, and now he's kind of very much into mechanics. So he built a prototype of injectors to see how the real rackets are made. So he took the flat disc and started to drill the holes at the different angles or parallel to each other. And he pumped water. So it was very much spectacular when he had a few holes that were giving water flow at the angle, and then you had at the end always the collision between the two streams, and you had atomization, if I properly pronounce that word, atomization, at the end of it. If you have any comment about it, but, you know.
Talking about the they call them the shower head. That's where the gas is pushed through a bunch of little holes, and then that enters the combustion chamber. And what he's talking about is the guy had, he tried larger holes, thinner holes, and then he tried angling them at different angles. He found out that worked the best. If, you know, when gases came through, it was fine, and you know, the way it was coming through, but when they were, they call them axial holes, where one would be coming at one angle, another, the gas be coming in at another, and they would be, you know, hit each other, and it would atomize even more. So he's trying to refine the system, and that's what we have in, like, for instance, the space shuttle, a lot of these different rocket engines. So he's trying to duplicate that on a small scale. And you know, he had this camera, I think it was like 60,000 frames or so that he could film the gases going through. He's really into it. You know, I'm more into the overall design. This guy going right down to the fine nitty gritty, which is okay. I think it's a little too esoteric. But I wonder, Wesley, he said he was going to finish and maybe make more videos. Did this guy ever make his rocket engine? Did he ever finish? Back to you.
As far as I know, he was doing an art in this area, but he didn't finish yet. He made another video. Actually, in the same video, he made a copy from the plastic to show all of the elements of rocket engine, and then he... They tried to make from the metal. I know that he was considering centering. Centering, for some of you who do not understand, do not know the term, is actually using metal powder and then put it into the form and press it with the high pressure hydraulic press. And then when you release the press, you have a green stage of it, and then you go with it to the oven, and the part of that metal powder, particles melt with each other, and you have a ready stage to be used. Actually, plenty of that is being made with centering right now. Let's jump. Okay, like handles in your door locks or faucets in your heat sink and so on. There are plenty of them done this way. I was once considering to buy such a press, but I didn't have much really safe for it to have to keep it. It was quite cheap. Okay, another subject to discuss, the new spacecraft that Boeing was working for many years at had some problems, technical problems, which Elon Musk didn't report that he ever had. And I was kind of shocked to hear that. Can you comment on that?
I didn't hear any comment from Musk regarding the Starliner. Let's go back to the showerhead design. You know, that's pretty much used for the shuttle, the RS-180 engines that the Russians make. Boeing has them to fit, you know, they're being phased out. And also the F-1 engines for the Saturn V engines that has that system. A lot of the newer engines, like the SpaceX uses the Raptor engines, you know, or the E-1 engines for the Falcon. Those are fed by pintle, they call them pintle type of injectors. You know, so the idea, the theory is very similar to what you would have on a nozzle, you know, for garden hose when you open up, close the trigger, you know, the pintle part pushes forward or comes back, and they're able to control the spray entering the combustion chamber. So, you know, there's different designs, but the newer ones tend to use the pintle type of design. Now, I haven't heard anything about his comments, but I was going to talk about Starliner later. Back to you, West, WS-1.
Yeah, it is. Maybe I didn't formulate myself properly. So Elon Musk didn't comment on it. What actually happened is, in Boeing version of the rocket deliver astronauts to the International Space Station, the engines stopped working, and not one but few of them. And I compared it to the Elon Musk vehicle that where no such problem was ever reported. But talking about the scale of Boeing's, let me try. So talking about the scale of Boeing referring to Elon Musk, it was kind of strange that would allow that to happen. So that was kind of interesting for me.
Yeah, well, you're comparing apples to oranges. You know, it's a different way of doing things. Boeing has all kinds of senses. If something goes slightly over limit or on the limit, it'll you know, shut something down temporarily, and then they'll look at it, and then they'll find a way around it. And that's up to five of those thrusters. They got a little over. It's a software problem. They got over limit, and the software is set. You know, they could change that. They could raise it or lower it. And they verified, well, there were five that have a problem. And what they did is they fired one at a time, and they'd ask Butch Wilmore, the commander, did you feel anything? They were doing a count, let's call it manually. And he would feel that one, and the next one. And four out of five are fired, so they still have problems with one. They have built-in redundancy, triple redundancy. So Boeing's really not concerned with it. They had similar problems with the vehicle one of, a couple of years ago, docked with the space station without a crew. Problems with the reaction control thrusters on the service module, not on the command module, which is important, you know. The only thing that really comes back is the command module. Those service modules, ones with the thrusters that have little problems, they'll never see that. That will eventually burn up in the atmosphere before they return. But they haven't wanted the next one that they build. They'll adjust the software. They've already talked about that. I did see the conference that they had afterwards. Back to Wesley.
Wesley, are you out there?
We lost him. We lost him, Roy. Alright, he'll be back someday. He'll be back. I I think he has backup radios, that says Roy.
I think so. I'm not quite sure if it's another case of someone throwing out a dead carrier or his microphone connection failing. Last time I saw him, he had other radios. I don't know if he has kind of A-B switchover radios, but he has other radios. Give him a little bit more time. If not, maybe I'll do the TechNet puzzle.
Yeah, sounds good. You're DFQ.
Very well, you know, thank All Star. It's easier to just go through All Star. Plus, I could do full duplex, so if anyone steps on me, I can hear immediately and either quiet down or tell the other person to quiet down. So it's a beneficial type of situation. The only trouble is, once in a great while, All Star just kind of lost it. Either it loses the audio in or the audio out. But aside from that, it's pretty good.
Okay, am I coming out now?
Yes, you are, Wesley.
Okay, so my question was, why it was said that a vehicle is going to be used instead of Elon Musk's vehicle that was proven to work?
I kind of missed that. Something about Vega? That's another rocket. Try that one again, Wes. You know, not your signal, I just didn't understand the question.
Okay. So the next one was, I sent you the videos showing a first landing on the moon. And one was showing that it was real landing, and the other one was showing that it was a fake. Did you see those, and can you comment on that?
Okay. Yeah, thanks for sending it. But anytime I see anything talking about, you know, fake landings or fake anything, I skip over it. Life is short, so I'm one of those guys, Wes, you know. I think they say 6% of the population believes we still didn't land on the moon. But, somebody was trying to duplicate the same picture that, you know, when Neil Armstrong was walking on and he's standing there saying, one small step and this piece of equipment comes flying down out of the sky, hits the guy in the back. Really bizarre. So I kind of skip over stuff like that, Wes. Back to you.
Dr. Roy, do we have a cut on it?
Not much. I mean, you could fake anything, and as Paul mentioned, it gets kind of tiresome. You know, there's conspiracy about most everything and anything. So, you know, six of one, half a dozen the other. It's not. I don't consider it anything particularly special. There have been people. I won't even go list, but there are people who think that JFK is alive and JFK Jr. is alive. And all kinds of silly stuff, so it's just more silliness.
So you say that the second video showing it, showing the falling equipment and the crew laughing or filming it was not true?
Yes. We went to the moon. Dick kind of got their transmissions in this broadcast, so, they went to the moon. Again, you could fake anything. It's not that difficult, and unfortunately with AI, it's getting increasingly easier to fake almost anything that you're inclined to fake.
82BHD.
Yep.
Just a fine point, being that this is a technical net, the words conspiracy, the word theory, have specific meanings, and we should use them appropriately. Regardless of where we stand on them, they have specific meanings, and they're smeared these days as unable to transmit a thought, but they're valuable words, and we should use them appropriately, and that hasn't been happening in the last couple of minutes. I make no stand on any of the conspiracies or the theories, but we should use the words appropriately. Just my thought. 82BHD.
Okay, Jim, you're free to have your thoughts, and I'm free to have my thoughts.
Oh, I wasn't talking about any thoughts. I wasn't disputing any thoughts, just that the words have certain meanings, and we should use them to express what our thoughts are. That's all.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, if Jim saw this video, this stupid thing coming down, hitting the guy in the back. I mean, it's glass, but, you know, it definitely doesn't come under, well, that doesn't come under theory. That comes up. Well, if you want to consider it a conspiracy, it's ridiculous. I don't know where you got this thing from, Wes, but, you know, there's a lot of weird things on the Internet. And, you know, like I said, life's short. I don't want to spend my time looking at stuff like that. I only have a certain amount of brain cells that could absorb this stuff. Back to you, Roy Westwind.
Okay, very good. Back to you, Wes.
Okay. The next question, William Anders. Paul, please.
Yeah, that's that was Mikey News. Roy, I'm doing a space net report here. Back to you, Roy. It's a shame we lost an astronaut, Bill Anders, in the early days when he was flying. It was always Bill Anders, and I know his name's William, but unfortunately he went down on an airplane in a pungent sound in the state of Washington, all by himself. Nobody else with him. But he was one of the good guys. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
It's called pungent sound?
Is that the way? Yeah, up in the state of Washington, he was flying an airplane, Beachcomber, I think it was, airplane, and 90 years old. You know, I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was medical or mechanical, but he went down. And Bill was one of the three that went to, first three people that orbited the moon 10 times and came back. And he took the famous photo of, you know, Earth, and that's one of the all-time best photos, you know, recognized around the world when he did that. He was up there with Lowell, and the commander They made him president of Eastern Airlines when he came back. Frank Borman. Back to you, Roy.
He took the famous Earthrise, as opposed to Moonrise, Earthrise picture. And NASA has taken other images that are vaguely similar. I have an Earthrise picture on my wall as well.
You know, I got a gigantic poster, Earth. I mean, this thing is probably, it's got to be 3 feet by 2 feet. It's unbelievable. A gigantic poster of that thing.
Two, Steve.
Yeah, Chris?
You guys are leaving out a major point to William Anders. He was 90 years old, solo flying a little airplane around up in. And by the way, Paul, it's a Puget Sound, and I believe you were wondering, Roy, where what he was talking about, Puget Sound up there. But William Anders was 90, solo. I can't believe he's solo flying one of those little airplanes up there. Crazy. Hit you, STP.
WB2EA.
I thought I said that. Did I say Puget Sound? What did I say? Anyway, I did say 90 years old, I believe. Anyway, Roy, back to you. And I haven't spoken to you in a long time. That's pretty, very good. Roy, back to you. I'm going to stand by and let you continue on with the TechNet. WS2.
WP2EAD.
Ed Rice, give me a minute, Ed. Paul said 90. He said it quietly, but he said 90 years old. And I kind of thought it might be Puget Sound because my desktop computer is made by a local company in that area called Puget Systems. But I thought it was pungent because that's an interesting name for a sound. Anyway, Ed, you wanted to say something?
I read he was flying a T-34, which is not a little dinky airplane. It's basically a jet fighter.
Gee, well, you know, I mean, if you got to go, I guess that's as good as any way.
I mean, let me be clear. It's a training thing to learn how to fly jet fighters. You know, it doesn't have guns, but otherwise it's a jet fighter.
Yeah, there's a conflict. A couple of different news people have come up with different airplanes for that one. But I can't imagine he's flying a jet flyer. He lived up there. I can't imagine him doing that. But we'll look further into it. Back to you, Ron.
Okay. Well, you know, 90's a good age. You got to go sometime. But yeah, I do really love that Earthrise picture. It's one of those pictures that have been overly processed. A lot of NASA imagery of the Earth is based on close-up satellites that aren't able to take in the entire image of the Earth. So they do patches, and then they do color corrections and exposure corrections, and then they do mosaics, and they patch them all together. And it doesn't look as good to me personally as a real, you know, real-time image of the Earth in one fell, you know, snap of a shutter.
There's another one also, the pale blue dot.
Yeah, I think I saw it as well. I like the idea of both of those. Again, we've been kind of fed many processed images from NASA, not because of any conspiracy going on, but just because most of the images are created by cameras that can only take a portion of the Earth in any snapshot. But both of those are very beautiful pictures. I love most of the imagery that comes back from NASA.
Any question? Wasn't that at the cell phone MS? I mean, it was reported that he didn't take the cell phone with him, but the phone doesn't work. At a certain altitude, it's not being read by the cells on the Earth. But he had a radio. And wasn't that possibly the exemption was made for such a famous person at 90 to monitor him as others, like the Dr. Wright?
That makes no sense.
Okay, I have no clue whatsoever. I have no knowledge in this particular subject. People are able to bend a couple of rules. Glenn, I think didn't he go up to the ISS or something when he was a senator or something? You know, he was not probably something that NASA would have done for any Joe Schmo senator. So sometimes you can pull some. I don't know what happened in this case.
No, 70 went up, Roy.
No, Roy, no.
Yeah, still 76 to go up in the ISS. I mean, you know, the average 76-year-old calls up NASA, and I think they tell them to take an aspirin and call their doctor in the morning. But, I mean, John Glenn was a famous guy and had a lot of connections, so he was able to accomplish it.
Yeah, he didn't go to the ISS. He was an orbital mission. That predated the beginning of the ISS. I mean, Mir was up there, but they didn't go there. It was an orbital mission.
Can I elaborate, Roy?
Certainly.
When somebody went up on one of those things, you know, from older people, they were passengers. This guy was flying the plane. There is no room for nonsense. People die without nonsense. They will absolutely die with nonsense. He had to have a valid medical certificate allowing him to fly. He had to have a flight plan. He had to have had recorded radio communications. He had to have ASB flight track data. This stuff will all come out. We may never find out what happened, but I promise you, we absolutely will find out what happened in exactly where he was at what time, what he said, stuff like that.
WSN.
Okay.
He had two houses, and one of the houses was in the state of Washington. He didn't like the crummy cold weather up there, so he recently bought a house in California. So I'm assuming he was, you know, flying home from somewhere. any details, we'll find out. Roy?
Okay, I mean, they'll release more information, whether it will be all of the information, is part of the information. We may never know that portion of it, but we'll see as this thing unfurls.
Let me give you a recent example.
Go ahead.
You know, there used to be this outfit, two lawyers, Salino and Barnes, and then they split up, and you still see Barnes Group advertising on television. What people don't realize is he died in a plane crash, in a plane flight. They're absolutely baffled what happened. They can tell you exactly what he said at every second, where the plane was at every second. All of that stuff these days is de rigueur. Usually, they can figure out what went wrong. Not always, but you will always know exactly where the plane was at every second and what the pilot said at every second.
Okay, but I mean, not always do they release all that information to the public. They might summarize it and release the summary, but I don't think there's any particular law, to have public access to all the flight records, but I could be wrong.
You're wrong, Roy.
Well, okay. Again, not a lawyer, not a pilot, so... Okay, if everyone has the right to just kind of request all the telemetry and such, then someone's going to obviously do that.
It's standard. Now, it's due. You don't have to ask for it. You have to run and hide to not get it.
Okay, so, I mean, what happens? They post it on a public website? Or, you know, because it sounds like it's even easier than just requesting it. It almost sounds like they just have a bulk mailing to everyone.
There are dozens of websites on this. The FAA has a pile. The National Transportation Safety Board has a pile. When there is a fatal accident, they come out. NTSB sends people on site. They do a full preliminary report, and then use about a year, year and a half later, they do a final report. Now, in theory, that involves every crash. The problem is, you know, the more public attention a crash is getting, the faster they do it, because they're under the gun. If you have a problem in your putt-putt and you walk away, good luck waiting for it.
Okay, it's just that I would think that you're a miserable dirtball and you do YouTubes about plane crashes and such, and you're able to actually play the audio as the guy is crashing into the mountain or whatever. I guess to be totally wrong. It just kind of strikes me as something that lawyers could probably do something about.
Thank you, SCP.
Yeah, Chris?
I can tell you, I'm not sure about private pilots, but commercial pilots, they do not release and will not release any audio. And the reason for it, they will do a transcript if people are going nuts and really want to know. It's on transcript, but the Airline Pilots Association has been fighting that forever. They do not want that audio, and that's why it's not allowed to be released to SCP.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Again, it's not like I'm a pilot, and it's not like I'm a lawyer. It's just that it strikes me as that if that was possible, you would see a bunch of really tarab YouTubes that centered on endless streams of people hang out as they crash into things, which I don't think any family member would want to have available on YouTube or anything. So I kind of think, yeah, transcripts are one thing, audio files of people dying, that's a different thing. Although, you know, if people were around back in the 80s, there was this particular woman who was, I think she was a traffic reporter for some radio station. She'd gone to the radio, into the helicopter, and report on traffic. And her helicopter went down, and they told her, "We're sorry, but you got to go back into another helicopter." So she went into another helicopter, and that went down, and she died there. And there was audio as she crashed, and it was a terrible, terrible thing to listen to.
Yeah.
Actually, this YouTuber was arrested. He faces federal charge over the video of a woman shooting fireworks from a helicopter at the moving Lamborghini. Are you talking about that?
No, none of us are talking about that. Most of them are talking about the NASA astronauts that you mentioned. I'm talking about a traffic reporter in Newark back in the 80s. She didn't do anything wrong. She was doing traffic reports, and the helicopter failed, and she crashed, and she survived. The pilot, so the station told her that they're paying her to report the traffic via helicopter. So they put her in another helicopter, and that went down, and she died. I believe also the pilot died during that accident.
I assume you have no idea why two helicopters crashed in quick succession.
Okay. So I think there was coincident, because you said something about the YouTubers, and then I recall that information. That's a 24 years old guy who is making a high stunt YouTube videos is charged, federally charged for placing explosive on his airplane. So, imagination of some people is outstanding. I mean, it's in the punk way. And
oh, and one other thing, Roy.
By the way, at the time, again, this was something like 40 years ago, at the time there were these vague comments about how radio stations were not paying a premium dollars for well-maintained helicopter services.
Well, that is possible. Usually if two helicopters go down in short order, there's a common thing with the weather. You know, helicopters, there's one thing. Helicopters can't just fly on instruments. Instruments are intended to get you from one airport to another. If you're just puttering around, you know, instruments is no help. So if you can't see the ground, you're toast. But here's my point. On YouTube, there is at least half a dozen people who do commentary on airplane accidents, and they are all very, very, very serious. Now, there are some issues about this, about that, but one of them looks in camera and says, I'm trying to keep you from killing yourself in your airplane, and I want you to know what went wrong, what people did right, and what people did wrong. And it's very serious stuff, and there's a number of them. They all know each other, interview each other. It is very informative, and a lot of pilots and people who are interested in aviation are addicted to this stuff because you often find out what went wrong, what they did wrong, and what they should have done instead.
Yeah, I could understand. This could be life-saving information. This is not entertainment. So I understand where it's very important for people who find themselves in those positions where knowing the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do is the difference between walking away from something and not walking away from it. So I am entirely.
Okay, one more thing to go, and then I rest my case. Can I?
Okay, this is not exactly a court of law, but okay, Leslie.
Okay, thank you very much. You have a pretty good sense of humor. Yeah, I'm trying to learn your English, but I'm not successful so far. So does Dr. Michael Mosley, the BBC presenter name, say something to you?
Thomas?
Not particularly.
Okay. So, Dr. Michael Mosley, BBC presenter, was found dead at age 67 on Greek Island. He was a British medical journalist and documentary producer, pretty much known in Europe. Actually, there was almost not just few people who'd not know his name. He was a TV personality. So he was at the rocky beach of Anga Marina, according to local officials, and 5 days actually, that was June 9 when he was found. But 5 days they were looking for him. older guy, about 17 years old. And, of course, many of us meaning that 70 years old is not old yet. I remember KCTWGP was 74. Anyhow, after the end of military police and the government of England and a huge amount of people moved, it was found 10 meters away from the sea in the cave. They screened all of the cameras whatsoever, so, and he didn't take the cell phone with him. So the question, medical question to you, doctor. Should the older person always come the phone with him? With you, right? Back to you.
Well, like most questions and answers, it depends. I mean, if there's a workable cell tower someplace, then certainly, yeah. It's always nice to have an emergency lifeline. If you're going to go to a location that doesn't have any cell towers and doesn't have any reception, there's not much you can do with the cell phone, unfortunately. Then you're probably better off with a satellite phone. But yeah, I mean, yet 3 years old, it's always nice to have an emergency, you know, red button to press.
At the risk of being irritating, WB2AV has a different comment here, too.
Feel free to irritate at any time that you want to, Ed.
As a lifelong hiker, backpacker, and scout leader, here's the rule. Never hike alone. And if you're off marked trails, like for example, if you're hiking the Appalachian Trail to Harriman State Park, on a nice day it could be like Grand Central Station, so that doesn't apply. But the rule is never, ever, ever, ever bushwhack alone. Never go off the marked trail alone.
Yeah, it is good advice. But isn't that that many of us, when they are on vacation, they think they got just gone, want to go alone somewhere with no phone whatsoever. They don't think that something may happen, Dr. Roy.
Well, again, yeah, see, they might get away with it. A lot of people get away with a lot of things. It always strikes me as bizarre, as foolish things that people often do. But fortunately, they get away with it until the day that they don't. So, once again, Ed, excellent advice. Thank you. As a leader of Boy Scouts and et cetera, excellent advice. But again, even if you've got a friend there, it's always nice to have a cell phone if you are in an area that's accessible via cell phones, or you might want to rent a satellite phone just if you belt suspenders. You know, try and stay as safe as you can.
But if you lose consciousness, it's off and on.
That's quite true. So, if either you or your friend has a satellite phone or a cell phone, and the other one can get help at a faster rate than tracking back to some landline.
Let me be clear about something.
KB2VHD.
The cell phone is a God-given miracle. Not because it allows kids to text each other from 8 feet apart, but for that very, very, very reason. Ability to call for help with a cell phone has gone up by orders of magnitude.
Yes, I agree with you, and like I said before, you know, if they're ever able to integrate some kind of a low Earth orbit satellite system with phones, that would be peachy keen as well.
Even just with cell phone service, it still is a tremendous miracle.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, Ed. It's kind of changed the entire communications of individuals with each other. For good, for the most part, but occasionally for the bad. You know, we now have people who are kind of stuck in little cubicles of their own making. You know, a bunch of people sitting at the dinner table, no one's talking to each other, typing away on their cell phones. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I love the topic. Very good thing to talk about. But as much as I agree with that synopsis of safety and never leave the trail alone, I will point out that the course of human progress, had that been the case all along, we would have progressed nowhere. And I think it's more important so that people take a reasonable accounting of their risk. And so for the most part, yeah, if you're going off on a walk through the woods, you might want to say, but philosophically, if that's your way of thinking, we'll discover nothing. And most people discover nothing. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But thank God some people discover things. All relevant. Back to that.
And thousands and thousands of those who tried, they are lost to history.
Absolutely. No argument.
If people want to take risks, there's still a lot of risky things that they can do. Some people enjoy risks. Do you kind of stretch your parameters when you do that? Yeah. Do you accomplish great things? Occasionally. Do you get yourself killed? Occasionally. So, you know, I mean, it depends. Everyone has to decide on what is an acceptable risk and what isn't an acceptable risk. And I don't think people should just do things for the sake of risking their lives. I think that, you know, there are situations where the risk increases, but at least the benefits possibly balance it out to one degree or another. Again, I leave the individual to make their own risk assessments, because I can't do it for you.
Comments? Well stated, Roy. I agree.
Okay, someone cried out comment, so feel free.
Okay, Roy. Elliot, Echo Lima, Lima, India, Oscar, Tango, Tango, Kilowatt 1, Mike Foxtrot, Norwalk, Connecticut. I just sent you a link to the WNBC helicopter accident with Jane Knocker, or what her name is, who happened in October of 1986. That's the one where she was going to record, and the clutch on the helicopter seized up and went down, and she closed my door because back to the night, you know, along with my clutch truck.
Yeah, thank you. I just got the email. Jane Knocker is kind of unusual name. And it was awful. You know, I'll probably never forget the video, that because they showed it all over the damn place. But, you know, she went. I don't think it was the weather. Ed made a comment that sometimes multiple helicopters will fail because of weather. I think I haven't kind of looked this lately, but I think there was a couple of weeks between the first helicopter and the second, because it took her a little bit to get her courage up to go into another damn helicopter. She probably would have waited longer. But thank you, Elliot. I appreciate it. Okay, Wes, are we kind of done for tonight, or is there anything else?
No, I believe that's all for tonight. There is another case with a few guys with quite a Middle East name that were involved in scam where doctorates were shunning, and the clients were paying, but the airline company was actually used for that scam. But I believe that is not a subject to be discussed here, or at least tonight. It was wonderful time spent, and plenty of people were very much involved in that discussion. Thank you very much.
Well, Wesley, thank you, as always. Let me do my little micro technical tonight. It has a little preliminary story. In honor of D-Day, let's go back to the very beginning, unfortunately. The piezoelectric effect was discovered back in something like the 1820s. The Curie brothers discovered it. That's when you take a crystal and you distort it, and it produces a voltage potential. Fast forward to around the 1920s, and they perfected the quartz crystal for oscillators, a very high resonance device. Amateur radio operators took to it, but not much else. Military, I don't think they were that interested. And so manufacturing was not a big thing. There was a very low demand for it. So it was a handmade product. You basically had to find a very good quartz crystal, something with the facets remaining, so that you could orient the crystal, because it has to be sliced at a particular coordinate system. They have different coordinate systems. They have AT cuts and BT cuts and GT cuts. It all has to do with the orientation to its axes. So in order to have a well-made piezoelectric quartz crystal, you have to know the angle. You know the angle back in the 20s, you had to have facets. And so they manufactured relatively small yield in crystals until World War II. Now, World War II has the same thing going for as far as coaxial cables. Coaxial cables were invented decades earlier, but they were too expensive to manufacture. But once the Army decided that they wanted a lot of coaxial transmission lines, they made it very efficient, very, very cheap, and they had a lot of surplus at the end of World War II. So hams that were reallowed to use the radios could buy relatively inexpensive coax cables, and it changed the nature of amateur radio. But getting back to quartz crystals. So they had a lot of problems. There's only so many faceted quartz crystals. They were importing them from Brazil, apparently. So developed over the first years of World War II better in the technology. They used polarized light in order to get the orientations close. They used X-ray diffraction equipment that had been developed earlier to really get a close, you know, get the angles really right. They cut them, they buffed them, tested them, they put them in little brass holders with phenolic insulators, and they shipped them all over the place. And a lot of the hot and humid areas of war and airplanes, the crystals failed because they slowly went higher frequency than they were originally designed to do. So they went back to the drawing board, and they used toothbrushes and soap to clean the surfaces so that the humidity wouldn't...
That was just getting interesting when Roy disappeared.
Okay, am I back again?
Loud and large.
And we never lost it. Through Selden, Roy, 100% all time.
Ah, okay. Go figure. Anyway, so the big problem, they had a lot of problems. The major problem was using brass, it interacted with the phenolic insulators, and it degraded the quartz crystal and caused it to go high. Also, when they just kind of abraded it to be thinner, it wasn't perfectly smooth. And the moisture would get onto the projecting particles and disrupt the frequencies and would go higher. So they had a whole bunch of problems. But eventually they learned to etch the thing, and it worked out pretty well. If it was below frequency, they would just keep etching it until it was on frequency. Originally, if they overshot it and it was too high frequency, they would put it to the side and would use it for the next frequency up. In other words, they would just abrade it even more to make the frequency go up even higher, until some bright people discovered a way of lowering the frequency of an already designed crystal. So tonight's TechNet little micro puzzle is, how the heck do you change a crystal and get it work at a slightly lower frequency than it was built to?
Yeah. Using the graphite. You would take the graphite, you would take even the pencil. I mean, not every pencil. and you just put it on the side of the crystal.
Okay, let me put it this way. There's probably kind of ways to fudge it a little bit, but not in a military spec grade type of way. I don't think the military would like that method because they would think that would be a little bit too, it may work, it may not work, it may stay working, it may not stay working. So let me change it a little bit and say, if you were the military, how would you ultimately decide to lower the frequency of a slightly higher designed quartz crystal?
I know what they did, and I know why I've done it.
Ah, very good, Ed. I was wondering whether that would be part of your knowledge of military history and such. So please feel to give it away.
You get a nice lead pencil, you know, graphite, but not a number three pencil, like a number one pencil. And you just scribble across the quartz plate. That will lower the frequency.
Okay, Wesley actually suggested that. But I'm talking about a different technique that is probably better suited to anal retentive military spec sort of guys, as opposed to kind of scribbling on the quartz crystal and just putting it into the machine and seeing if it added a little bit of weight so that it lowered the frequency. There's a way to accomplish it that's much more military style.
Yeah, the reason that I gave you that technique is because that technique was first used by the Germans during World War II. Then it was stolen by Russians, like they like to steal everything possible. I'm sorry, I'm not there was Russian at that time. I'm not trying to be. And it was used in all Warsaw blocks, so many countries, and it was normal, it was considered normal. It was a technique that was militarily used, and French uses 60s. So I was kind of puzzled when you said, well, no, this is not the technique that is somehow known to the military technique.
Okay, well, I mean, the Russians always like to use pencils. You know, there's the old joke about how American astronauts decided that they wanted things in zero gravity, and so they found a company that makes a gas-filled ink cartridges, and the Russians just took a pencil out and used a pencil that you could use in zero gravity. But, I'm talking about the American, mostly, I guess, or the Allies. Apparently, based on a video which I will put onto my link page, and you can look at it in its glory, it looks like it made back in 1943, so it's kind of endearing in that way alone. But there's another method, it's a little bit more Buck Rogers in the 23rd century solution.
Vacuum pack them somehow?
No, I'm trying to think. Vacuum pack would have made much of a difference. It probably would have been more difficult to maintain the vacuum, and I don't know if it would actually lower the frequency. So no, it's think outside the box, I guess, because it wouldn't strike me at all. It was the fact that it was an unusual solution, because I had already heard about the pencil and stuff. Because there's a lot of helps, hints and kinks in UST that talk about adjusting an old crystal that don't need anymore for a frequency that you need. So this is a little bit outside the box. So
okay,
think about it for a couple of seconds.
Doctor, are you talking about the power resonance frequency increased by using inductance across the crystal, or are you talking about the capacitive wave of doing that?
Neither.
So, adding inductance across the crystal causes resonance frequency to increase. By doing it with capacitance, you actually decrease frequency to you.
Yeah, that's just externally tuning the quartz crystal. The military wanted to make the crystal out of the box be resonant at a specific frequency, and they had ground it a little too thick. So They wanted to split for the warfare. Because they really took it seriously. Back in those days, no one had the technology to produce synthetic quartz. Nowadays, people just grow quartz crystals, so it's nothing. But like I said, they had to import them from Brazil, and high